This is Bump and Stacey
on Seattle Sports.
Streaming through the Seattle Sports app and at seattlesports.com.
Now, here are your hosts, Michael Bumpus and Stacey Ross.
Here we go now.
Sticking with the Mariners with ESPN's David Schoenfield joining us now on the Emerald Queen Casino Sportsbook Hotline. Hey, David, how's it going?
I'm good. How are you two doing?
Fantastic. We're so happy to have you on. Now, there is a lot of good to talk about with the Mariners, and I do want to get to so much of it. The pitching, winning their sixth series, very briefly, and they can still absolutely do this, being in first in the AL West. This is a very competitive division, so lots of fun stuff. But I have to start with the offense, and I have to start with the strikeouts, because, David, Bump and I have spent an hour trying to go over all the theories that we have about why this offense just can't get it going, why they strike out so much. Is there anything you've settled on?
Well, I'll try to be nice here. Look, Seattle is an impossible place to hit in April, right? So let's chalk up some of the struggles to T-Mobile Park. I still call it Safeco because I'm old and I forget things. But yeah, you know, and we know that. I've seen a couple local stories, you know, talking to the players. So, fingers crossed, the weather warms up, that marine layer dissipates a little bit. Maybe the offense will pick up a little bit, you know, the rest of the year. But, yeah, that doesn't avoid the fact that strikeouts are strikeouts, and they have the highest strikeout rate in the majors, when the whole goal of this offseason, right, was to bring in players who don't strike out as much. So, and I'll say this, too. I don't want to, by any means, pin this all on Julio Rodriguez, because the one thing bad organizations do is often blame their best players. But, you know, let's be honest here. Julio's the man in this lineup, and he has to be the man. And when he's struggling like he is to hit for any power, striking out a lot, not walking, there's just no momentum that the rest of the lineup picks up from that. I'm a believer you do feed off your best hitters, and you need your best hitters to produce. And that's not happening right now. So maybe that's the other positive view, is once Julio heats up, and I think he's going to, then maybe the rest of the lineup heats up.
David, like Stacey mentioned, we've been trying to figure this thing out, and maybe by the end of our show at 2 o'clock, we might just figure this thing out.
But, we'll solve it.
we're another thing we've leaned on is just philosophy. In my experience, I got a football background. When I was in high school, there was a lot of coaching going on. You're building a foundation. You're teaching an offense or a defense technique. You get to college, there's still a lot of coaching going on, less than high school, though, because you're dealing with a different caliber of player. You get to the NFL, that was the least I've ever been coached. It was just, all right, man, this is the route. This is the defense we're seeing. Get to your spot, or I'll find somebody else to do it. What's that like in baseball? Because I'm trying to figure out how much the coaching and philosophy really affects the player's execution. Are they getting really coached up and hammering down on technique and philosophy? Or do they let guys like Julio kind of figure it out themselves, and they give them little hints here and there?
Yeah, it's a little of both, right? You certainly, coaches, a lot of it's the analytics and the numbers more than the actual techniques. I mean, to a large part, your swing is your swing. You know, of course, you want to teach batters swing at strikes and don't swing at balls off the plate. Easy to say, harder to learn. That eventually, that has to come from the player. You know, either your brain learns to adapt, and in Julio's case, he can't lay off sliders away, you know. And it's a little frustrating because this is his third year now, and you want him to improve in that area, especially like some other young guys like Bobby Witt Jr. continues to improve. Julio, he's not any better than he was as a rookie, and that's, I'm sure, it's frustrating to him and certainly frustrating to fans, but you can't just teach lay off the slider. Either your brain learns to do that or it doesn't. You know, but technique, philosophy, yeah, that's part of it, no doubt. I mean, look, the Mariners on the pitching side, obviously they've been great at developing pitchers, teaching guys the sweeper and a new pitch, you know, so that's a technique part of the game. But hitting's more you figure it out or you don't. That's kind of my opinion.
Does Julio compare to anyone else there? You mentioned Bobby Witt Jr., Kansas City Royals, by the way, kind of a fun start to the season, as being someone who's continued to develop. I don't want to take away from who I think is an exceptionally talented player, maybe the most talented player Seattle's had in like 20 years, David, as you know.
Yep.
But you also, you don't want to get too down on thinking like, well, what if there's a fatal flaw? Are there other players where you look around the league and you go, look, Julio can still be an MVP caliber player if he can just do X, Y, and Z?
Yeah, and look, he's been, what, top 10 MVP the last 2 years,
yeah,
right? So, and we know what he brings on defense. We know what he brings on the bases. So, yeah, no doubt the talent is there. I'm going to make a really scary comparison. I hate to bring this up, but think of a guy like Javier Baez. When he came up with the Cubs, he had this kind of talent. And he never learned. He finished second in the MVP voting 1 year in his best year, but he never learned the strike zone, and now he's almost unplayable. Julio's not as bad. Like, Javier is like the worst you can have at just swinging at everything. But that's sort of an example of what can go south, you know, as the pitchers adjust and you fail to make those adjustments. I mean, 44 strikeouts and 7 walks. It's just, it's hard to be successful as a hitter with that kind of ratio. You're just not going to find your superstar hitters. They don't do that. You know, maybe 2-1, you know, your best hitters like Juan Soto might walk more than they strike out. Those are rare in this day and age, but you know, once you get sort of past a 2-1 strikeout to walk ratio, that's when it's the line becomes fine, you know, because then you're not picking out pitches you can drive, you know, that you can hit for power. You know, again, hopefully Julio's right now just in his own head more than anything, and we'll get out of this. But, you know, it's an issue for sure.
There was some hype surrounding this team to start the season, and rightfully so, right? You look at that rotation, you go, you should have a chance in most ball games with the guys you're going to have on the mound. But then you look at the offense, you go, all right, well, they're averaging, what, a little over 3 runs per game. I believe the highest is close to 6 runs per game. Is this sustainable? Because they're winning games. And we, Stacey and I sit here and we go, all right, well, they've won, what, 6 straight series. They are winning ball games, but is this going to be good enough to really hold the title as a contender? Do you think this is an avenue to which they can sustain and really stay in the mix when it comes to being a contender? Or do you feel like eventually you're going to need more production?
Yeah, I would say probably the last. You're going to have to score a few more runs. I mean, they're at the bottom, right? 14th in the AL in runs scored. I don't know, God, who's worse than they are. That's hard to believe. But look, every other team is trying to scramble to fill their rotation, right? So that's clearly a strength. As long as everyone stays healthy, they'll get Brian Wu back here, which just adds another arm. I mean, frankly, I was a little concerned about the bullpen going into the year, especially once Matt Brash and Santos went down. Bullpen's, you know, it's been terrific, probably better than expected, you know. So you also got to sort of milk in a little regression maybe from the bullpen. But bottom line, they're going to have to hit. And look, just – you got to go through the track records here, right? Julio's going to be better. They'll get J.P. Crawford back.
Yeah.
Once he returns, he's going to be better. Mitch Garver, I think he'll be better, but he's 33. Mitch Haniger, he's 33. Those two, you know, and they're supposed to be your meat of the order, but you worry a little bit about their age, you know? So at one point, do you start then thinking, oh, we better make a trade. We might have to bring somebody in to add to this group.
Let's talk about maybe their ceiling and floor. MLB's power rankings had them kind of shifting down, but this was after winning 6 consecutive series,
yeah,
which is really impressive in itself. The starting rotation has been absolutely phenomenal. We haven't seen a stretch of dominance like this. But I can also kind of understand the argument of like, ooh, how much faith do we put in a club that's 26 in average, that's leading the league in strikeouts? So how good can they be? And do you believe that the offense can improve to even just being average?
Yeah, look, there's no doubt. Again, if the rotation stays healthy, I think this can still be a 95-win team. Maybe that's the upside, you know. Downside, I think at the worst is, I mean, you could have 3 starters get hurt and nobody hits and you win 75 games. I don't, you know, but you could say that for every team. So worst case, they're kind of a 500 team. Best case, 95 wins. You battle the Rangers for the division title. You know, once again, I think the Rangers are off to a slow start. I don't think they've played up to their level, you know, either. There's just pitching right now is tough in this league. It's hard to keep guys healthy. It's hard to keep five guys effective in a rotation throughout a summer. That's going to help the offense. Once the attrition of the rest of the league sets in even more, you're going to face more and more, you know, call-ups from AAA and whatnot. That'll help. But yeah, it's tough. You know, it's weird, right? Because I know fans are optimistic. They were in first place up until last night. Pitching's been phenomenal, but it's so frustrating just for the lack of off. It would be nice, wouldn't it, just to have like three games in a row of 8 runs, 9 runs, 7 runs, like, that would be nice.
It sure would. You tell me they score 8 or 9. That's a W in my book, man. Let's look at the AL West. What are your thoughts? You know, the Mariners did a good job handling the Rangers. They handled the Astros. But overall, what do you see here?
Yeah, look, you guys, you know, we just saw Houston. If I'm an Astros fan, I'm really worried about what you've seen so far. I mean, you don't want to write them off yet. There's just too much talent on that team. They're going to start getting a little healthier in the rotation. A lot of guys out right now, but again, their bullpen's, you know, been a disaster, which is a surprise. But I'm not going to write them off. But I don't know, they got a long ways to go to improve. But the Rangers, you know, look, at some point they're going to get Jacob DeGrom back, right? You know, that's going to be a big lift. Yeah. They'll get Max Scherzer back. Corey Seager, I think he just hit his third home run last night. He's off to a really slow start. Wyatt Langford, supposed to be this rookie of the year. His only home run was an inside the Parker. So that offense hasn't clicked. And we saw last year when that offense clicked, how scary it can be. So the Rangers are going to be there. A's, fun story. I'm not counting them to be in there all year. And the Angels, they're already looking ahead to the draft. So I think it's going to be Texas, Seattle, you know, down to September for sure.
We all expected that the two best teams in the league, certainly offensively, but just all around teams, would be the Braves and Dodgers. And so far it's looked like that. But there are a couple other fun teams. David, if you were to step outside of Seattle, who's one or two teams kind of catching your eye that you've really enjoyed watching through the first month?
Yeah, I mean, the big surprise has been, you know, Baltimore is great. We know that. Phillies has the best record. No surprise there. But yeah, Cleveland, kind of built like Seattle, right?
Yeah.
Depending on the pitching, Cleveland, not a lot of power. Their offense has been pretty good. I'm not buying into it. They have a really high average with runners in scoring position. That's probably going to regress. But yeah, they're 23-12. Jose Ramirez isn't even hitting that well. But just a fun team that, like Seattle, rely on pitching and defense and timely hitting. Cleveland's getting a little more timely hitting these days than the Mariners. Again, can they stay in there? You know, if you run down their rotation and compare it to Seattle's over the long haul, you're taking the Mariners. And Stacy, you kind of briefly alluded to the Royals. They're fun because they were terrible last year, and they actually went out and spent money in the offseason. Here's the thing, though. Most of those guys they brought in, like ex-Mariner Adam Frazier, aren't doing anything. It's kind of the young guys like Bobby Witt Jr., who's just a stud. You know, again, I don't know if they have the depth to hang in there, but it's fun to see a small market team, actually, or a mid-market team, Seattle, spend a little money, you know, and
for the little and medium guys.
Yeah, the medium guys, you know, like, and Seattle's not that medium. They're closer to big than medium.
Right.
But, you know.
Always love having you on. He is ESPN's David Schoenfield. Tons of good insight per usual. David, thank you so much. We appreciate your time. We know you're busy.
Thanks, David.
All right. Hey, you bet. Anytime.
See ya. Again, thank you to ESPN's David Schoenfield. Some interesting stuff that he could see the upside if the rotation stays healthy as being a 95-win team. That Julio, you know, has always had trouble laying off the slider. He said, look, you lay off it or you don't. Like, you might have to look at some other interesting comparisons. What you want is for him to keep improving the way that Bobby Witt Jr. has, but he's kind of struggled with some of the same things. He also has the potential to be one of the best players in baseball. So what do you do with those juxtaposed versions of someone?
Julio's such a a beautiful mystery.
Yeah.
You look at him, you see it. I mean, everything that he does, but then you look at the numbers and say it's not adding up. But then you look at what he's done over the past couple seasons and say, all right, just hold tight because it's about to happen here pretty soon.
I also agree with the teams that he's liked watching. I always, you know, hate if they're teams that are going to be competing too much with Seattle.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, the Royals have been pretty fun. Guardians have been really interesting. Yeah. A couple other teams out there. So it's always interesting to spend just a minute or two with the national guys being like, what's the view on Seattle from the outside?
Yeah.
And also, what else is going on? Tell us what we need to know.
They're always more optimistic.
That is true.
Yeah.
They always, because there's no emotional thing at stake. Although David is a fan of the Mariners, but it's always interesting, like when Buster Olney joined us to start the season and he was like, yeah, I've been talking to people who think like the Mariners could win the AL West, that they could be really great, because if they don't, okay. You're not hinging your hopes and your summer on that happening. Let's get to Four Down Territory.
This is Four Down Territory, going inside the game with former Seahawks and Coug wide receiver Michael Bumpus.
First down, Bump, which three players who are at different stages of their careers are you looking forward to seeing bounce back in 2024?
First, I'm looking at the old man Aaron Rodgers. Man, how are you going to bounce back from that Achilles situation? And what did the Jets do to support you? They did go out and get a really good offensive lineman in Olu the Kid out of Penn State. I like what they did at the receiver spot. I'm telling you, this is my Tank Dell from last year, Malachi Corley from Western Kentucky. They went and got another running back. Jordan Travis, they got a backup plan, another running back, a corner, a safety. Look, they said, we're going to make sure you're protected on offense. We'll give you a couple weapons, and we'll see what you do there. Now I'm looking at Joe Burrow. This is like a rite of passage for Joe. All the great ones get hurt at some point. Peyton Manning, Tom Brees, Roethlisberger, Drew Brees,
yeah,
Tom Brady.
Yeah, but we knew what you meant.
Drew Brees, Tom Brady, Roethlisberger, they all go through it. How are you going to bounce back from your ordeal? Now, what did they do? The Bengals did the same thing. We're going to get you an offensive lineman. We'll get you another weapon. Let's see what you do. Now, my last one is Kyler Murray. He's the one who was really weird for me because you see all the talent this young man has. He came back and did his thing, and they went and got, in some people's eyes, the best receiver in the game for him, and then went and got a nice edge rusher in Darius Robinson. Three guys at different parts of their career. Aaron's on his way out. Burrow is approaching like the seventh hole in his career. And then Murray's kind of in that gray area. He just shot a horrible front nine. Can he bounce back in the back nine? We shall see. Those are my three guys. Looking to see how they do.
Second down. The Seahawks just tendered cornerback Michael Jackson. Why has he been important to the Seahawks secondary?
This is the type of dude you need. There are more Mike Jacksons on football teams than superstars. And you look at Mike McDonald's corner rotation last year. Some guys got banged up, but he played six corners in Baltimore. Or you got Pritchard and James, who had fourth round grades, but they were drafted later, so they're going to force competition. But the constant is going to be Mike Jackson. He might not be, well, he actually did run a fast 40, as fast, jump as high, as tall, as long as these guys, but in 36 games, he has 21 starts, 111 tackles, one interceptions, 19 passes defended. He is solid as heck. He's the guy to where you say, look, Reek's not having a good day or a good week, Mike Jackson's going to be good to go. He doesn't have that freshman smell, that fresh car smell that Pritchard and James has. He's a guy that he can be relied upon. He's going to go down on special teams. He's going to make plays there. There are more Mike Jacksons on football teams than any other type of player. He's a catalyst, man. So I'm happy that, you know, they kind of they slowed the process down a little bit. They still got to work some things out, but that shows you that they realize how important he is. McDonald likes to play a bunch of corners, especially if they're not getting it done or they're injured. Mike Jackson is going to be a big piece of this.
Third down. Bucky Irving is expected to compete for reps in the backfield for the Tampa Bay Buccaneers. Why can the combo of Rashad White and Irving be different from most running back combos? I'm very interested in this. Also, how did this scenario remind you of the Seahawks?
I like this RB combo because most of the time when you talk about running back combos, there's thunder, there's lightning. There's a thick one and a thin one.
A 1-2 punch.
Yeah, good 1-2 punch you got in the backfield. And yeah, they could be a 1-2 punch, but in a different way. Rashad White had 64 receptions last year. That was fourth amongst running backs. Yeah. 564 yards receiving last year, third amongst running backs, and three receiving tight ends. Bucky Irving, when you look the way he was using that Oregon offense, he did run for over 1,000 yards, but he also had 413 passing yards or receiving yards and 56 receptions and two touchdowns. This could be the more dynamic future of the running back position, where these guys can receive out the backfield and you don't really know what you're going to get. They can run the football, but they're both capable of swinging out screens and all that good stuff. We look at 1-2 combos. Typically, they're different type of running backs, and you can narrow down the playbook and see what you're going to do. This reminds me of the Seahawks, because I'm still waiting to see the guy who in 2023 led all college running backs in receiving yards in Kenny McIntosh, and saying, where does he fit into this whole situation, and how is Ryan Grubb going to use him? You have a 1-2 combo in Ken Walker and Zach Charbonnet, different type of running backs, but they both can get downhill. Kenny McIntosh can be that X factor. So I'm looking at the backfield with the Tampa Bay Buccaneers, and I'm saying, nice combo there. Same type of running back, so that means the playbook is wide open. You can't narrow things down. How are you going to use your 1-2 combo and maybe have a third punch in there with Kenny McIntosh, because he can receive the football? He's got a brand new start here in Seattle. Hope he takes advantage of it.
Bucky Irving has a name that is tailor-made for being in a broadcast booth after his career.
Facts.
You know what I mean?
Uh-huh.
And on the call, Bucky Irving. Like, it just, it's like a mix between Bucky Brooks. And yeah. It just sounds like a broadcaster name.
It does.
You know?
It does.
Fourth down. What phase of the game will have the most adjustments in 2024, and how can it affect the Hawks?
We're talking about the kick game and kick return game, I should say. Even kickoff cover as well. And before I looked up the stats, I go, I wonder where the Hawks were when it comes to average. I was like, they're probably middle of the pack. The Hawks were fourth last year when it came to kick return average.
I would not have guessed that.
26.2 per. Now the top is 26.7, so they're not too far behind of being the more explosive team when it comes to kick returns. So I'm looking at that, and I wonder how that influenced the way that they drafted and the guys they bring in for tryouts and mini camps and all that good stuff, because I think this can be a big part of the game. The NFL wants to bring this back. So I'm looking at special teams, and I go, all right, maybe that there's a place for Kenny McIntosh right there. That's why I was entertaining bringing Rashad Penny back, because we know what he did at San Diego State. This is huge. I think this could be a big year. The Texans had two returns for touchdowns last year in the kickoff game. Other than that, you got the Broncos with one, New England with one. If you can get one or two returns a game, you can change this all up for your offense. Good field position, get extra points. If you score on a kick return, I believe years ago, the average is like you win 70% of the time or something like that. So the Hawks aren't too far away. Top four when it comes to return average. Let's see what they put back there. This could be big for these dudes.
You can bring back one thing to football. Number one, changing some of the rules against defensive players so that you can get some of those hits that we used to see even during the Legion of Boom era. Yep. Number two, more kick returns.
Those are two great ones. But I'm going to bring back the defense. And this is coming from a receiver.
Yeah, from someone who was also a specialist.
Yeah, get nasty out there, man. It's a dangerous game. And that can change just the identity of a game. That big hit going across the middle. Now you got receivers looking over their shoulder. It's different. I like it, though.
I will just say, something about kickoff, especially kickoff return touchdowns, just stick in my memory.
Mm-hmm.
Like, to this day, I remember standing in my living room watching, is it Hester, return it for the Bears against the Colts. I still remember that.
Yeah,
and I was
Hester,
pretty young.
Ted Ginn.
Yeah.
Dante Hall, Leon Washington.
Man. You're listening to Bump and Stacey on Seattle Sports and the Seattle Sports app. Coming up in the timeline, an officiating controversy dominating the NBA playoffs. Don't go anywhere.
This is The Timeline
with Bump and Stacey.
Brought to you by 1-800-DUIOA.
It is The Timeline on Bump and Stacey, reading you the top stories you're going to see and hear about on your own timeline. Of course, the NBA playoffs are front and center. And if you aren't following closely, that's okay. We're going to get y'all caught up because you're a sports fan and you want to know what's happening, right? So here we go. Did the refs steal the Pacers' chance at upsetting the Knicks in game one? There was also a controversial call yesterday, but we're going over stuff from game one. They were down 118-117 with 12 seconds left. Indiana had the ball. They had a shot at tying or taking the lead, but center Miles Turner was whistled for a ticky-tack moving screen call. Take a listen to the play-by-play here.
Here is Halliburton. Shot clock is off. Indiana down a point at Madison Square Garden. Turner will be called for an offensive foul on the screen.
That is shocking. You never see that call at this point in the game.
Wow.
I mean, never.
DiVincenzo hit the deck.
sold it. That is a great acting job. A lot of great actors here in New York City. You see them on Broadway all the time. That's as good an acting job as you'll see.
Questionable call.
And all moving screens are questionable for the most part. There are a few that are just blatant and you can get it. If you have to say, I'm surprised they called that at this point of the game, then you're just wrong. They should call it consistently all the time. Well, we watched the national championship, and I was mad because I go, look, man, you cheated Connecticut out of a chance. But here's the thing. You just have to be consistent. Whatever you call, if you call it in the first quarter, you call it in the second, third, and the fourth. But, yeah, and these basketball players are as close as we get to soccer players with our four major sports here. They will flop. They will wince.
Yeah.
Especially my man LeBron. Goodness gracious. But thankfully, this wasn't LeBron. If you call it in the first, you got to call it in the fourth. If you're just looking at the rule, I guess, but come on, man. Let the dudes compete and settle it themselves.
That is not the only call to have gone against the Pacers. Now, Indiana challenged that one, and then the call was upheld upon review, and that was obviously the one that got more attention. But there was also a call that referees later said they got wrong. This was from Monday night's game as well. During this call, which was a kicked ball violation, the Pacers weren't allowed to challenge it because that was just the call. And then the refs later said, our bad.
My bad.
We didn't mean that. We called that one wrong. We're not too happy about it. So the Pacers really taking issue with this series so far. Pacers head coach Rick Carlisle said this.
I don't want to talk about the officiating. We're not expecting to get calls in here. You know, it'd be nice if they laid off that one, but they didn't. So, you know, that's just the way it goes. I mean, we challenged it. They reviewed it. They got a bunch of people in New Jersey that agreed with them. So that's just the way it goes. So, you know, we got to learn from that too. That's a timing play. Both guys are involved. So we'll have to execute that better next time.
Now, you want to be able to say, oh my God, like these calls really cost them the game. And maybe you can. However, you also have Jalen Brunson for the Knicks, who just had his fourth consecutive 40-point game.
How about
they're
you do that?
Ballin'.
How about you stop Brunson? But here's the reality of that situation. You asked me this question during the break. I didn't have an answer for you. Why are you limited in what you can challenge? You look at the UFL. You can challenge any and everything in the UFL. Why do they limit what you can challenge, especially late in the game where calls have implications? You can influence the game. I think it always comes down to the guys on the field. I mean, on the court, the field, wherever you're playing, right? Bronson did drop 40 of them things on you. It was 14-14 from the free throw line. So you fouled the heck out of him. He took advantage of that. He was also 14-26 from the field, over 50%. Start there and play defense. But when you get late in these games, you should be able to challenge some things because who knows what happens after that. The coach is supposed to say exactly what he said. We're not going to get calls here. Let's not leave it up to them. Let's go wild and play. But the league has to look at itself, too. And the messed up part is the coaches can't even hold the league accountable or they're going to get fined. It's like, just deal with it. These are grown men. I say that to my kids because I said so. I don't have to explain nothing to you. I told you to go clean your room and do it right now. You go ahead and do it. This ain't that situation. So I like the coach's perspective and not really dwelling on this whole thing. But the league also has to ask themselves that question. Like, why can't you challenge that, especially when it's late in the game?
All right, next story in the NBA, and then we'll move on to a couple other ones here. Over the weekend, Jimmy Butler caused some controversy when he said the Celtics would be at home if he was available to play in the series. He hurt his knee during a play-in tournament loss to the 76ers, and so he was talking some trash, which, like, congratulations, the Celtics weren't going to lose, though. Meanwhile, though, Heat team president Pat Riley has some advice for his own star, Jimmy Butler.
You know, for him to say that, you know, I thought, is that Jimmy trolling or is that Jimmy serious? You know, if you're not on the court playing against Boston or on the court playing against the New York Knicks, you should keep your mouth shut and your criticism of those teams.
Facts.
Look, normally I would say keep your mouth shut can come off a little harsh. Yeah. However, you weren't out there, Jimmy. You weren't out doing anything.
You at home. You're at home. The Heat are at home. You and Tyler Hero are getting at it on the bus. This is, you know, every now and then I think sometimes guys might be at home. You have a little sip of something and you're watching a game. Like, man, I would cook these dudes. Mm-hmm. Man, put the phone down or hand it to somebody. That's what I do. Before I tweet, I hand it to my wife. Like, look at this. Thoughts, critiques, grammar. What you got for me? Yeah, man. And I love Pat Riley, man. You know where he started off, man. L.A., baby. And he is just a no-nonsense type of dude. I love it. Perfect message. Jimmy, I hope he's not in his feelings. Respect the OG.
Well, hope you're not in your feelings. Something worth considering. Jimmy Butler is looking for a contract extension. So this is also a little bit of sparring between Riley and Butler being like, oh, you want this extension? Well, I'm going to need for you to be a leader. I'm going to need for you to, importantly, play.
For the most part, he has, though, man.
Yeah.
Jimmy's been great to the Heat. I mean, yeah. He got him to the finals of the bubble by himself. Without Jimmy, the Heat aren't relevant.
Do you think Jimmy doesn't mean, and this is not, I think, what Jimmy Butler is implying, but do you think that you inadvertently also insult your teammates by saying that if you were there, they wouldn't have lost?
No, I don't think so. I don't think the teammates are
in their feelings about that.
No, I don't think they are. I think they're good.
The Indianapolis Stars' Greg Doyle has been suspended 2 weeks by his employer. He won't be allowed to cover Indiana Fever games in person. This stemming from comments, we covered this in the timeline a couple weeks ago, that he made to Caitlin Clark at her introductory press conference following the WNBA draft. He had like an unprofessional, kind of awkward, cringeworthy interaction. He later posted a column to the Indy Stars page apologizing for it. But look, it's up to that company if they want to decide, like, we don't think this behavior is becoming of our journalists, so we're not firing you, but doling out a suspension. I think if they want to do that, that's fine.
It's a little weird. It was a weird interaction.
It was a weird interaction.
You know, and we all do like some cringe things. Like, I was traveling somewhere last weekend, and I scanned my boarding pass. Have a safe flight, you two. You know, like, there are weird interactions going on. That was a weird one, and it's nice to set the tone. I think they did a good job setting the tone and saying, you must behave in a certain manner if you want to cover our team. And, yeah, he'll be back, and he'll learn from it and put out great work.
I feel like people always want to get on, like, the world for cancel culture, and some people might be seeing this as, like, why is he being fired for whatever? Because companies reserve a right to dole out punishments feels hard the ways that they see fit, and because they felt that that professionalism was lacking and they want him to learn his lesson. They aren't firing him. People are going to forget that this even happened in a couple months.
Yep.
It's not that big of a deal. He issued an apology and took full ownership. He was like, you're right. You're so right. That was beyond. I'm so sorry. Mm-hmm. And sometimes people do things wrong, do what they need to do to make up for it, and then it's fine, and then we move on. But I don't know. I thought it was unprofessional. I didn't think it was like world ending. I thought it was unprofessional and weird, and he learned an important lesson. Okay.
Yeah. And Caitlin probably ain't even tripping, but
no. You
have to set a standard, and that's exactly what that did.
All right, you guys, we are about a little under an hour and a half away from the dugout. It's all Mariners from 1 to 2. Shannon Dreher getting things started at 1. Don't go anywhere.
You're listening to Bump and Stacy
on Seattle Sports.
Here are your hosts, Michael Bumpus and Stacy Rost.
Coming up at noon, one more thing that we learned from David Schoenfeld that is a very, very, very interesting stat when we talk about what might be going on with the offense. I hadn't even considered it. That's coming up in 15 minutes. Before we get to it, we are talking Seahawks. We've been pretty heavy baseball, heavy Mariners today, but this is a team that's made a lot of really big offseason moves. They didn't dominate free agency, but they did move on from some key players, Jamal, Quandre, Will Disley. Jordan Brooks has moved on. Your starting guard, Damian Lewis, has moved on. You brought in some big pieces. Importantly, you actually used your pick at pick number 16. So, Bump, let's take a look at free agency, the players that have left and come in, as well as the draft, to answer this question. What message has been sent to Seahawks players with this team's offseason moves? Forget what I think about it. Forget any message they're trying to send the rest of the league. I don't really think they care what the rest of the league thinks. What message is being sent to the players still in this building by what's been done personnel-wise?
For receivers, running backs, and quarterbacks, they said, we good. Y'all work this out. All right, we spent a third round on Sam Howell. We needed a backup. Receiver-wise, didn't make any moves. You picked up a couple in undrafted free agents. But y'all good. Stay healthy, learn the playbook, learn grub, get ready to go. Offensive line, they're saying, all right, we got our guys. We have our tackles, but we're also going to draft a couple tackles to compete. We have a center, but we're going to bring in a center to compete. Not really sure how that's going to work out. And then the guards is an open competition. They're looking at that offensive line and saying, we got some pieces, but we're not complete, especially with a guy leaving and Damian Lewis. Y'all got to go out there and prove it. We're also going to bring in some veterans to show y'all how to do this too, a George Fant and the rest of the gang. Now when I look at the corner position, the secondary, I look at the corners and I think they're saying, Rick, you had a good first season. Sophomore season was a slump. You got to get ready to go and compete. Devin Witherspoon, you're so versatile. We might want you at the nickel spot. We might want you at the corner spot. Either way, someone's going to have to back you up. But don't worry. Colby is still on the roster, and Mike Jackson is still on the roster. Y'all got to go out there and compete. The only person at the corner spot that is safe is Devin Witherspoon. Mm-hmm. Whether it's corner or nickel, he's the one who is safe. So they told the secondary, y'all got to go out and do your thing. The safety spot is interesting because they went out and they got a couple veterans to fill that void. They did not address it in the draft. Whether that be because they didn't see a safety that was talented enough, or they felt that Julian Love is going to be good to go, which I believe. I think Kobe Bryant, I mentioned him at the corner spot, the nickel spot, because we've seen him play every one of those spots, but he's going to compete at that safety. You bring in Kevon Wallace. You got Jarek Reed, who was injured last year, and Sutherland is still on the roster as well, but you brought in Rashad Jenkins. They told everyone that unless we did not draft your position, it's open. Y'all got to be ready to go. At that linebacker spot, you get Tyrese Knight out of UTEP. You're bringing guys in Baker and Dotson on a one-year deal. That's a competition. In a way, Mike McDonald is still all about what Pete Carroll is all about, which is competition.
Yeah.
You're going to compete. There's not too many rosters where you look at the starters on offense and the starters on defense and you say, all right, 80% of you guys are good. It's not too many of that because there's always movement going on. Guys are getting older. Guys aren't performing. But I look at what they did and what they didn't do, and a clear message to the guys, the receivers and quarterbacks and running backs, that you guys are good. Everyone else, you got to come out here and compete, and I like that. And if you listen to how Mike McDonald has addressed the media after his rookie camps or rookie practices, mm-hmm. I think you get that feeling as well.
Okay, I have a lot of similar sentiment. I'll start with the offensive line. You mentioned the guards open competition. I wrote, oh, well, anyone can get it. Like, just this idea of there was no, like, we can assume that Christian Haynes is a front runner for a starting position.
Yeah.
I don't know that he'll be working with the ones in camp. He'll probably have to work up to that. Maybe you'll get some veteran preference there. But, like, Phil Haynes is still a free agent.
Yep.
So it's not like you have veterans that are here necessarily. Charles Cross, your job's safe, but I mean, Olu, you want to take that job from Nick?
Compete.
Hey, Lake and Tomlinson, you're a veteran. We trust that you can get this, but you got people on your tail too. So there's a ton of competition there. There is significantly less competition at defensive line, which is why the message sent to this defensive line is you better be great. This is not a message sent in like, oh, vote of confidence, you know, try to improve. Hey, Leonard Williams, we paid you. Hey, yeah. Dre, we paid you. Byron, we took you at 16 overall. The expectation for this group in particular is higher than almost any other group. This cannot be one of the weaker units on this team.
It should be. Because if you just, let's imagine each one of these players at their peak. If they are able to stay healthy and play 75 to 80% of the snaps. Uchenna Nwosu is a Pro Bowl type of guy. If he plays most of the snaps, he gets double-digit sacks. Boye Mafe, now I'm integrating the outside backers to this line, right? Boye Mafe is a guy who's gotten better every single year. He's gotten better, 2 years, right? Going his third year. He's gotten better. Leonard Williams changed this defense a bit when he showed up. Jay Reed at his peak is a good ball player as well. And then he still got Dre Jones. I haven't even mentioned Byron Murphy yet. We're still waiting to see what Cam Young can do. There was, I forgot what... site put something out, but they said low key, the Seahawks are putting together a top five defensive line. And someone sent it to me, one of my players, and they said, "What do you think, coach?" I go, "Possibly, but we got to see who stays healthy and who performs." Every team has potential at this point of the year, but I really look at that defensive line and go, if these guys continue to grow or just be who they are when they're playing at their best. This could be one of the better lines in the conference. We'll see how it stacks up to the rest of the league. But, yeah, I'm loving this defensive line right now, but you know how this goes. You got to stay healthy. We lost a couple guys last year, and you got to perform.
Better lines in the conference would be pretty impressive in its own right, the NFC, with some really good defensive lines. I agree 1,000% on your take on the corners. Devin's the only safe one, and that's also very important because Rick Woolen was defensive a player of the year nominee, had plenty of accolades as a rookie, took the league by storm, tied for first in interceptions. But the message is very clearly, hey, we need 2022 Tariq and not 2023 Rick Woolen.
Facts.
That doesn't mean you change your name back. Mm-hmm. You be Rick. You be exactly who you want. But it does mean that you need to get back to whatever it was you were doing as a rookie.
You can't get comfortable.
Mm-mm.
There is a couple guys on this team who are comfortable, who are still going to go out and work hard, but they're comfortable. DK, Lockett, JSN, comfy. We know we'll be the guys in rotation. Defensively, I think Julian Love, Uchenna Nwosu, Boye Mafe, Devin Witherspoon. Everyone else is on that. You got to come out here and compete. Comfortable in a way that they know they're going to be the starters, but hopefully not comfortable enough to think that they got it all figured out. I love the approach. Make these guys compete. Competition breeds greatness. Go get it.
Last one, and I didn't save you a lot of time, but it's because I was stumped. Moving on from Will, Quandre, Jamal, it's not like you were trying to send a message to the team with that, but what message did it send? And
moving on from Jamal?
Moving on from it, you could choose one, but I wrote moving on from Will Disley, Quandre Diggs, Jamal Adams. I wrote like new era, no allegiance, question mark. Like what message would you be left as a player with that?
That this is the NFL, and it's rare that you can go to sleep every night after a game, win, lose, or draw, especially in the offseason, and be like, oh, I'm good. I've got to work on me.
Mm-hmm.
There's always a young man trying to take your job, and the NCAA does a great job of producing those guys. So as soon as you get old, as soon as you stop producing, they're looking. And even if you are producing, they're still looking. Guarantee you they looked at quarterbacks in this draft. Guarantee you they looked at running backs and receivers. They're always looking.
You're listening to Bump and Stacey on Seattle Sports and the Seattle Sports app. I know we all say the ballpark factor is just an excuse for this offense, but there is one stat that points to it being very real. That's next.